Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, the end of the runway for Mango as the business rescue bid finally collapses. Illegal tire dumping and burning sparks a new health and environmental alarm. Ultra-rare diseases are driving up medical aid costs and threatening sustainability. And the rooibos industry is pushing to remove the iconic South African crop from the US tariff list. It's Thursday, the 21st of August. After four long years of stop-start attempts to rescue Mango Airlines, the national carrier's low-cost subsidiary is finally, as I understand it, grounded for good. The revival bid has collapsed, marking the end of one of South Africa's most drawn-out business rescue sagas. Billions in public money, years of uncertainty for workers, and failed deals with potential investors have left many asking what went wrong. Who should be held accountable? Well, joining me now is Mango's business rescue practitioner, Sipho Sono. A very warm welcome to you. 4 years in business rescue. Why has this airline finally reached the end of the runway? Had all solutions been exhausted?
Jeremy, yes, I think we, as the business rescue team, we've tried our level best to navigate the challenges that were put on our path. The most difficulty we had to traverse was the resistance from the then Department of Public Enterprises for us and the team to use the funds to resume operations. So we were barred from using the money from government for operations, which doesn't make sense, which then made it very difficult for us to try to sell an airline that was not operating. That was the biggest setback. And also, even once we found an investor under the difficult circumstances, there was still resistance in approving the sale for a period of almost a year and a half. And after that, we then had to deal with the litigation from a creditor that was aggrieved by the structure of the payment process envisaged in the plan, took it to court, and unfortunately was successful. And so the investor we had then did not have the patience to await all these legal battles and decided to pull out,
Sipho, from the get-go, do you think you were on a hiding to nothing, given that government was both a shareholder and a creditor, and political contestation or interference must have played a role in derailing the rescue process, surely?
Yes, no, definitely. Without a doubt, political interference was too much. I mean, if you look back, we published a plan, the first version of the plan, in October 2021. And that is the plan that envisaged that we resume operations either in December 2021, or at the beginning of 2022. Although the shareholder had no say in the business rescue process, the shareholder managed to influence the government creditors like SAA Technical, and so forth, to vote against that initial plan, which then forced me to put a plan that had the approval of government, which was essentially what I just outlined to you. Yeah, it was always going to be difficult with a state-owned entity.
You've pointed to investors, and there were failed investor deals. I guess one at this point has got to ask whether the suitors were ever serious, or was the airline simply kept alive on false hope?
I think they were serious. I think they were serious. The investor we had saw a strategic fit between their current business, which is in the travel space. So they traditionally used to charter flights from Mango. So they wanted to do some kind of integration. So it made sense, you know, from my perspective.
How do you respond to the argument from some critics that SAA's interests were protected at the expense of Mango? In other words, was Mango sacrificed to save the parent?
Yes, no, definitely. I agree with those. I agree with those views because a decision was made that SAA and government no longer want to be shareholders in Mango, but money was provided for it to be rescued for the benefit of workers. But all attempts to do so were frustrated by the very same parties that put in the funding.
And the tragedy here, Sipho, is that thousands of jobs were at stake and that workers, if were not treated fairly during this prolonged process, and they paid the ultimate price, didn't they?
They did. Our initial plan envisaged some job losses, but there was a strong possibility that we could at least keep about 400 people employed with the money that we had from government. And the prospects of a sale of an airline that was operating certainly were much, much, much higher than trying to sell something that is grounded. And we had negotiated very reasonable lease rates with international lessors. So we did a proper business model, which we discussed with the Department of Public Enterprises several times. We presented the same plan to the National Treasury, but unfortunately there was no buy-in. Mm.
And ultimately, taxpayers footed much of the bill, and it's always going to be difficult to justify the billions spent when now we know Mango is never going to fly again.
Yeah, absolutely. The only thing I can say is that, look, as a business rescue practitioner, you work with what you have. So if you don't have stakeholder support, it is impossible to emerge successfully on the other side of the line. So we gave it our best from our side, but unfortunately we faced resistance from the people that shouldn't have tried to resist the rescue of Mango.
Looking back, what might you have done differently? Are there lessons that you have learned for further business rescue, particularly when it comes to a state-owned enterprise?
I think when it comes to a rescue of a state-owned enterprise, the one thing that I would try to do differently would be to get specific PFMA exemptions right from the start, because it makes no sense for government to say, sell the asset. But, you know, when you're trying to sell, they want you to make an application to sell and frustrate that process. Mm. So what I would do is to look at the specific PFMA requirements that make it difficult for a business rescue practitioner to do his or her work and get exemptions right from the get-go, so that then it can be done like any other business rescue without you having to go to government every step of the way.
And just a final question for passengers and employees who might still be owed money. Do they have any recourse? Will they ever see their claim settled?
Fortunately, the employees were all paid. So they had to be retrenched, unfortunately. And at that point, all arrear salaries and their retrenchment packages were paid. So there are no employees that are owed. We do have a few employees that are just still assisting us with a few tasks, but those are paid on a monthly basis. And when we wind down, we will pay them whatever leave pay they may have accumulated and all that, but that's not significant. With regards to customers, unfortunately, when we do a wind down, they get treated like creditors, which therefore means the projected payout to creditors of about 11 cents to the rand will equally apply to the customers.
Thank you very much indeed, Mango's business rescue practitioner, Sipho Sono. I do appreciate your time. Thank you.
Smart minds, big moves, one summit. Join the country's leading thinkers, doers, and decision makers at the MoneyWeb Money Summit. It's happening on the 9th of September at the Sandton Convention Center. It's one full day of powerful insights, real opportunities, and bold conversations shaping South Africa's economic future. And the best part? Your ticket is free. Just use the code MoneyWebGuest when you register. Visit moneysummit.co.za now. MoneyWeb Money Summit, where smart money moves.
MoneyWeb at midday. for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, I don't know if you know this, but every day South Africa produces the equivalent of 70,000 passenger tires with no effective management plan. Many, and I'm sure you've seen this, end up dumped in fields, rivers, or even burned in communities. What's the consequence? Well, poisoning the air, the water, and people's health. Now, the Recycling and Economic Development Initiative is warning today that this is an environmental and health disaster waiting to explode. So I just want to find out how bad it is and whether there are any solutions on the horizon. I'm in conversation now with Stacey Janssen, who's Executive Director of Operations. Stacey, welcome. And how serious is the tire dumping and burning crisis right now? Is it getting worse?
Yes, it is getting worse. And the reason why it's getting worse is because we have 70,000 tons of tires coming into our environment on a monthly basis, and a daily basis, in fact, it's 70,000. And that's something very alarming, especially when I don't see any action being taken to get on top of the problem.
Let's talk about action in just a moment, but there are serious consequences, Stacey, particularly for communities living next to those dumps, I imagine.
Yes, absolutely. You know, illegal dumping is a health concern to us because tires are highly engineered products, and when they are dumped illegally, they contain certain toxic chemicals which leach into our soil and into our water. And when burnt, which we know happens quite regularly in the poorer areas, they release pollutants linked to cancer, respiratory diseases, and can cause birth defects as well. So our communities living near these dump sites and where the burning is happening, they're forced to breathe in this toxic smoke, and they are at risk for serious long-term health issues, all of which can be prevented if we create an incentive to not burn and to not dump. And that's why we advocate for waste management plans that create those incentives.
Let's talk about those incentives in just a moment. But my understanding is that government still collects a tire levy. Where's the money going?
Yes, well, that's a good question, Jeremy. So since February 2017, government's been collecting this tire levy, and to date they've collected approximately 5.3 billion rand. Our research shows that not even 50% of those proceeds are making its way out to the Department of Environmental Affairs for waste tire management. And this is our fear with taxes, environmental taxes, the money but doesn't address the environmental problem. It just gets applied to all of, or whatever pressing issues government deems the funds need to go towards at any point in time. And that needs to change too. And that can be done, of course, through a waste management plan where the fees are collected by an extended producer responsibility organization. And those fees should be applied to dealing with the waste through creating those incentives I was referring to earlier.
And Stacey, how difficult would it be to implement a solution like that? Where would the roadblocks be?
Well, remember, we've done this before. South Africa was internationally recognized for its waste management plan, the waste tire waste management plan, and that was between 2012 and 2017 when we had the private sector running the waste management plan. In fact, RDSA developed a model, implemented the model. And it collected over 306,000 tons of tires, created 3,500 jobs, supported 226 small businesses. And it was at no cost to the taxpayers because the levy is a cost of manufacturing. It's no different to occupational health and safety. We believe that every product designed should be designed to add to the environment, not to destroy it and not to impact it in a negative way. And so these plans can be switched on fairly easily. We do have the mechanisms in law which allow for the private sector to do what it does best, which is come up with solutions and implement them. And it's at this point in time, government has not taken those steps to implement. Instead, it holds on to the notion that a state-managed plan would be the solution for the country. And we know that that plan was withdrawn in June on the grounds that it was unlawful.
So, Stacey, does this sit on the desk of the Minister of the Environment?
Yes, it does. Just recently, he published an article, I think it was on the Sunday Times, where he was saying we need more action and less talk. And we hold him accountable to those words, because here we have waste, which is a means to driving economic growth. Research has shown, that done as early as long ago as 2016, that if we were to take 13 waste streams in the country and apply the RDESA model to those waste streams in terms of managing it through creating those incentives, we will add 1.5% to GDP growth. We'll be able to create hundreds of thousands of jobs. And it has the potential to generate something like 200 billion rands worth of revenue. Now, in a country that's battling to retain its taxpayer base and to create the jobs, this is a no-brainer to us. And yet Minister George is more interested in the international talk shops, when at home we have the solutions, we have the experts, we just don't have them all in a room solving the problem.
So surely it's time now to challenge this in court.
Well, we've been challenging government since 2016 in court. We've gone through various court cases, the most recent being the challenge to reviewing and setting aside the waste tire management plan. And that happened in June. And it's just, I don't believe it's a coincidence that the minister withdrew the plan in the same week that they were due to publish their record of decision to the courts. So, we will continue to fight this fight. It's important that we get on top of our waste. We are, you know, we have a situation where our environment is being damaged on a daily basis. And the problem with the environmental, well, fixing the environmental problem requires us to fix the economics of waste. And that is what RDESA has done. We've proposed it will cost government absolutely nothing to implement it. But government need to create the legislative environment where business can participate and do the right thing.
Well, we'll put all of that to the Minister of the Environment. I've been in conversation with Stacey Jansen, Executive Director Operations at the Recycling and Economic Development Initiative. Stacey, thank you very much indeed.
Mind-blowing. Innovative and internationally acclaimed, Le Petit Chef is a gastronomic experience like no other, a unique, never-to-be-forgotten 3D and 4K tabletop projected dinner filled with fun, surprise and storytelling. Fancy a journey across the globe without ever leaving your seat. You could win two tickets worth nearly 4,000 rand to experience the world's tiniest chef with the biggest culinary adventure. Enjoy 6 unforgettable courses inspired by Marco Polo's travels, from the fragrant spices of India to the icy peaks of the Himalayas, all paired with fine wine in a luxury setting at Blueberry Hill Hotel. Enter now at events@moneyweb.co.za and tell us about the official hashtag for the event. Your taste buds are ready for takeoff. Hashtag Dinnertime Stories SA.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, this is of some concern. Ultra-rare diseases, treatments costing millions per patient per month, are threatening the survival of South Africa's medical aid schemes. Smaller schemes face a brutal choice: fund these life-saving medicines and risk collapse, or deny members access. Now, the Board of Healthcare Funders says it has a solution, a cell-captive arrangement that pools risk across schemes. I want to talk now to the head of research at the BHF, Charlton Morove. Charlton, first of all, maybe just by way of context, give me an example of an ultra-rare disease. What are we talking about here?
Yeah, so based on my understanding as a non-clinician, these are very rare diseases. They okay, maybe once in a million population. And most of them, the ones where treatment is of concern, treatment is often in a drug which is administered. They call it enzyme replacement therapy. So the way the drugs are produced, it's very expensive because they say it's plant-based. It's not like your chemical processes. And obviously, there are not enough volume, so producing the drugs becomes more expensive. Now, examples are Gaucher's disease. I know that treatment can cost up to 5 million per year. Then there's one which was in the media recently, epilepsy, where treatment costs up to 6 million rand per year. So there are a few examples of these conditions which need very expensive medicines.
And explain to me why these costs pose such a unique threat to smaller schemes.
So schemes work on what people commonly call pay-as-you-go basis. Money collected within one financial year, over 90% of it is used to pay for claims in that financial year. The balance goes to administration expenses. Then the cycle keeps on going. So there isn't a pool of money which is set aside to cater for treatments. It's almost a budget basis. What you collect is what you spend. So for smaller schemes, you'll find that some of them rarely collect contributions in excess of 50 million rands per year. So if they were to find treatment for one of these, it then becomes a very big portion of what is actually collected.
And what happens to families then if the scheme can't carry the cost? The consequences could be catastrophic, disastrous.
Yes, I think these treatments are often life-saving. The difference between life and death, and they are needed. And when the scheme can't fund, then it's a big challenge for the families.
So in plain terms then, how would a cell captive arrangement work? What is the proposal on the table here?
Yeah, so when we initiated the project, we saw the challenges that the schemes were facing. In traditional financial markets, there's often reinsurance which is available to your normal insurers, where an insurance company takes out its own insurance, known as reinsurance, so that they can deal with catastrophic expenditure. I think an example is the Durban floods, for instance. The insurers then managed to survive because they had some form of protection. So in the medical schemes, there is provision for schemes to utilize reinsurance, but this hasn't really been happening. It's historical. So one of the challenges with reinsurance is you pass on underwriting profit to the reinsurer. So we wanted a solution which kept funds within the medical schemes environment rather than passing it on. So the proposal we have, schemes pull money together, and then if there is need for funding this treatment, it's paid from that single pool. And at the end of the year, whatever is left over is shared amongst the participating schemes. So it's a much more sustainable way of funding for these rare treatments without losing any underwriting profit to an insurer.
Would members end up paying higher contributions under the model that you're proposing?
On the contrary, no. So the fact that they are now pooling funds together to fund for this treatment, it makes it more sustainable for all the funders, because as it stands, they do keep a lot of reserves, even higher than the required margins, so that they can pay for these rare, expensive medicines if they do need to arise. But if we have this funding vehicle in place, the need for the excess reserves will be reduced. Then introducing the cell captive arrangement has got other downstream arrangements in that it standardizes how funds fund for these treatments, which adds on to several costs down the line. For instance, the rules which the cell captive will operate when funding treatment for the disease, there will be known in advance, there will be public knowledge. So there isn't much motivation over and above than what is published that will be needed. So it makes it easier even to bring in newer treatments into the country, because they will know how the rules operate. As it stands, when you are pharmaceutical and you want to bring in new treatment, you have to go and motivate at the various schemes on why that treatment is useful. That adds on to the costs of bringing the product onto the market.
Just a quick answer in conclusion then, where does the Council for Medical Schemes currently stand on approval?
So we have had engagements with the Council for Medical Schemes, just making them aware of the arrangement and how it works. So what will then need to happen is once we are done with everything, the schemes are ready, they will have to approach the Council for Medical Schemes with the reinsurance proposal application and show that it is in the best interest of the schemes to have one. Once they do that, then it will be approved and implemented.
Charlton Morove, thank you very much indeed. Head of Research at the Board of Healthcare Funders.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The South African Rooibos Council has stepped up talks with the Department of Trade and Industry and the U.S. Embassy, pushing for relief from Washington's newly imposed 30% tariff on all South African imports, and that would include rooibos. The council arguing that rooibos poses no threat to U.S. producers, as it's only grown in the Western Cape, while most of what goes to the United States is processed and packaged locally by American firms. With the U.S. making up around 5% of exports, the industry says the blow is real, but not crippling. Well, let's explore that in a little more detail. I'm with Davi de Villiers now, chairperson of the SA Rooibos Council. Davi, a very warm welcome. Against that backdrop then, how immediate is the impact of this tariff on rooibos exporters? You don't seem to be too worried, but you've sounded a note of caution.
Hi, Jeremy. Nice to be on your show. Yes, of course, we don't want to lose any market share anywhere, and 5% is real, as you say. And to put that maybe into a broader context, South African market is roughly the same size as the export market. So effectively, that's well under 5% of total rooibos sales. So yes, we definitely don't want to lose that. If we look at the knock-on effect of the tariff to shelf level, as you would know, there are a whole lot of costs in the supply chain going through. We estimate that's going to be around about 10%, maybe a bit under 10% pricing increase to the consumer. And that will only see the effect of in December, we estimate. That's when product that's subject to this high tariff will hit the shelf. So it's a wait and see game at this point.
So let's talk about the wait and see game. If it remains in place, could you quantify the likely cost to producers and exporters? Have you done that calculus yet?
No. And Jeremy, to be honest, it's quite a complicated thing, and it's something that the Rooibos Council does not keep stats on. We keep stats on volumes, but not on value. And value is a tricky thing because we sell a whole lot of different grades with different certifications, such as organic and so forth. So there's quite a wide range of pricing on the goods going through. So to do that calculation is very tricky.
But Davi, you would have a risk mitigation strategy in place, and I imagine the tariff is likely to push producers to pivot harder towards other global markets. That process must be underway already, surely.
Yes, Jeremy, it has been, and it has been for many years. If you have a look at where rooibos is sold these days, is in excess of 50 countries. There are about 10 that account for roughly 70% of the exports. So for sure, that is happening, and it continues to happen to a degree at rooibos council level. But the individual companies are quite creative in their marketing. They're pretty invested in getting rooibos into all sorts of new markets. So we're seeing interesting places and end users starting to take rooibos. So from that point of view, really, I think it's not a process that's just going to happen as a knee-jerk reaction. It has been going on for quite some time.
There must be concern, though, that smaller farmers maybe are at greater risk than the bigger players in the standoff.
Jeremy, yeah, I mean, if you look at the overall volume drop that we'll have, possibly, if the worst comes to the worst, it's 400 tons. If you take that into context of just the buffer reserves that we have within the industry, it really is a small amount. It's not going to be felt through the supply chain back to the farmers. I really don't think whether it's a small farmer or a big commercial farmer that there's going to be any supply chain shock that's going to be picked up.
So currently you are looking for some kind of exemption or relief. What kind of response have you had so far, that either from the United States or from DTIC?
Nothing yet. We have written to the DTIC, and we have obviously pushed this out into the media. So at this stage, also wait and see game on that front. There's an export desk that apparently is open, an export support desk for this specific purpose. So we've made contact with them. or we're trying to make contact with them. That process is underway, but no response yet. Jeremy, I wish I could say otherwise, but not yet.
And you've said, and just correct me if I'm wrong, that rooibos is processed and marketed mainly by US companies. It would seem to me that that argument should gain more traction with policymakers. But again, I would imagine the silence has been deafening.
Are you referring to feedback from the brands in the USA?
Correct, from the United States.
Yes. Jeremy, no, there also hasn't. Again, this is not at rooibos council company level like where I'm sitting at the moment. So they also are in a state of flux. They don't really know what the effect is going to be. Remember, a lot of these competing products to rooibos, botanical teas, if I could call them that, or herbal teas, are also coming from other countries where the tariffs are higher or lower, but certainly higher than they used to be. There's a lot of confusion about the effect of this tea space in the US. So there's nothing definitive yet.
And too early at this point, I imagine, while the conversation is just starting to reflect on real impact like job losses, for instance.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if there is job losses. We live in we exist in an industry that's quite cyclical on the supply side. So when we have rain, we have oversupply, and then of course we have a price softening at farm gate level, and then the reverse happens, and we have undersupply, and we have prices spiking. So that cycle happens, and that's the reason that the industry keeps quite a lot of buffer stock, almost to take that surge out. So there's no direct link between how fast the product's being consumed off the shelf and how fast it's being produced on the ground.
And just a final question then, Davi, what is first prize as far as the Rooibos Council is concerned in the standoff with the United States at the moment?
Well, two things there, Jeremy. First thing is obviously we'd like the tariff to be reduced to zero for the reasons that you stated earlier. It's only produced in the Western Cape, so we're not competing with a United States rooibos farmer. But the second thing is that the U.S. is a big market with quite a lot of disposable income, and it's actually, in our view, a very a highly underperforming market as far as rooibos goes. And we'd love to see rooibos getting into different supply chains, getting into different brands, and being more well-known, like it is, for instance, in Japan, where we have a fantastic market, the largest export market. It's growing. Rooibos is consumed for its intrinsic health properties and for what it is and its origins, all of those good things. And we'd love that to carry over into a market like the USA.
I'm going to leave it there. Davi de Villiers, thank you very much indeed. Chairperson of the SA Rooibos Council, I do appreciate your time today. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.